You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 29th of September, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. As it's Thursday, that means we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from russjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. How is life treating you?
Well, this time last year, I was bedridden with COVID, or whatever the heck it was. So compared to that, I'm doing very, very well.
Well, I'm certainly pleased to hear that. I do remember you taking off about a month, I think. It really did hit you badly. So we're very pleased that you didn't get long COVID. You managed to get over that, and you managed to come back to Radio Albion with your regular shows, The Orthodox Nationalist, and today on The Daily Nationalist with your geopolitical analysis. And today we're going to be talking about Sergei Lavrov's recent speech at the UN. And we're not going to quote the whole speech. We're just going to quote some selected highlights. And this is the first thing that he said. The future world order is being decided today, as any unbiased observer can clearly see. The question is whether this world order will have a single hegemon that forces everyone else to live by its infamous rules, which only benefit this hegemon and no one else, or whether this will be a democratic and a just world, free from blackmail and intimidation against the unwanted, as well as free from neo-Nazism and neo-colonialism. Russia firmly opts for the second option. Together with our allies, partners, and like-minded countries, we call for efforts to make this a reality. The unipolar global development model, which served the Golden Billion, who for centuries had been fueling its excessive consumption by relying on Asian, African, and Latin American resources, is receding into the past. Today, with the emergence of sovereign states that are ready to stand up for their national interests, an equal, socially minded, and sustainable multipolar architecture is taking shape. However, Washington and the ruling elites in Western countries that have fully submitted themselves to this rule have been viewing these objective geopolitical processes as a threat to their dominance. And obviously there's positive things about this, there's negative things about it, the mention of neo-Nazism, I mean, I do think that is overblown, but the fact that they are standing up for sovereignty and independence from America and from liberal progressivism is a very good thing, I think. Matt, what are your thoughts on this new multipolar development model?
I have to admit, I agree with you. The use of that term is used eccentrically there. I guess he's sort of referring to these, you know, what a very unpopular militias that have been developing over the last 20 years. But of course, they serve a cosmopolitan world order. But remember, the way Russians and Eastern Ukrainians talk, Nazism and fascism could also apply to liberalism. The homosexual agenda that's being forced on them. If any force or any anti-Russian movement, especially if it's using force, coming from the West. So it's odd, and I don't like the fact that he uses it, but that's what he means. But what he's talking about, if you want to summarize what's at stake here, this first section is the best. I've been saying this since the late 90s. And Lavrov is always much freer with his mouth than Putin. In fact, Putin can be maddening how overly diplomatic he is in his concern for fictions like international law. There's a lot of people talking about that now. But Lavrov says what Putin doesn't. He, of course, agrees with it, or he couldn't say it. But this is Lavrov is really the pit bull of the administration. You know, this imperial model isn't really much of a model. There's no development. And he's right. The switch from industrial to financial capital comes from really sucking the third world completely dry as its resources, rendering them just exporters of raw materials. And the only countries that have escaped that have done it through a firm nationalist military government. South Korea and Taiwan is another example. Belarus is a third, being able to survive the collapse of the USSR. But the comment about excessive consumption being based on exploitation of others, that includes American labor and the multinational corporations taking advantage of these countries around the world that are now drowning in debt. So it's not a development model. It's an anti-development model. It's a model of dependency. And just as the regime in America is cleansing anything, even vaguely right-wing American politics, Lavrov, who's noticed that and has condemned it in the past, including how whites were treated in Hollywood, etc., at the Jewish question with both Lavrov and Putin have mentioned. Putin mentioned it in the context of the Bolshevik Revolution. That this entirely derives from pure exploitation. It derives from the manipulation of currency, buccaneer capitalism, not actual production. And a lot of other things that Lavrov has said, not just in this speech but in others, that the U.S. just doesn't have the resources anymore. And the Golden Billion, I think I've talked about this before. That's kind of an old Bilderberg idea from decades ago, that really only 1 billion should be allowed to live on this planet. It's essentially the population control agenda. The Golden Billion, which is a Renaissance occult term, golden meaning the reasonable ones, which of course is just the elite. And of course, excessive consumption, that's what Americans are. That's why Americans don't respond to anything. They're moribund. You could do whatever you want to them. You could tell them anything, and they're going to accept it. Now, this is unraveling. I think 2020 unraveled it for a lot of people. But nothing seems to happen regardless, at least nothing that the press is going to cover. So as America is cleansed and forcibly made into this leftist neo-communist state, in other words, unipolar, Russia is doing exactly the opposite and advocating just the opposite. Multipolarity implies regionalism, nationalism, and ethnicity as essential actors. Not the only actors, but essential actors. And the Chinese are the same way. This is the foundational ideology of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Iran has just joined and Turkey has applied for fully, as is all of Central Asia. That's the organization I've been talking about for many years. And socially minded, meaning this isn't just about profit. This multipolar architecture really comes from American sanctions. As weak as they are, they do force Russians to look inward. It's creating a new generation of Russians that are fanatically ethno-nationalist and religiously nationalist in eastern Ukraine, Belarus, even parts of Central Asia. And it's bringing together this alliance. We've been talking about this since day one, the alliance that's formed the world's most powerful economies. Well, the U.S. is almost entirely deindustrialized. The only thing that registers as economic growth is stock buybacks and financial derivatives that come from, of course, production that's been offshore to Asia, Africa, Latin America. Well, of course, Russia has the exact same, and China has the exact opposite policy. So this is a great summary of everything we've been talking about I've been talking about for decades, we've been talking about since Radio Albion was founded.
So multipolar means nationalism and unipolar means internationalism. Lavrov continues, the United States and its allies want to stop the flywheel of history. Having declared itself victorious in the Cold War at some point in the past, Washington elevated itself almost to the rank of the messenger of the Lord God on earth, endowed with no obligations, only sacred rights to act with impunity wherever it wants. Any state can become the next target for such actions, especially if this state displeases the self-proclaimed masters of the world in some manner. Everyone remembers how wars of aggression were unleashed under far-fetched pretexts against Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya, in which hundreds of thousands of deaths were claimed among civilians. Were the West's legitimate interests at stake in any one of these countries? Have they banned English or languages of other NATO member states or Western media or Western culture? Have they labelled Anglo-Saxons as subhuman or used heavy weapons against them? What were the outcomes of the reckless undertaking by the United States in the Middle East? Have they helped improve the human rights situation or promote the rule of law? Have they helped stabilise the socio-economic situation or improved the people's livelihoods? Name a country where life has changed for the better following Washington's forceful intervention. So great stuff here that he's pointing out all the damage that's actually been done in Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya, and all these other countries that America has invaded. And he's pointing out what's been going on in the Ukraine with the way that the Russians have been treated when he's saying, has English been banned or other languages of other NATO member states? Matt, what are your thoughts on this section?
Again, this is an excellent summary of the political issues here. The liberal capitalist totalitarian model does claim that it has unlocked the secret of history in itself. Marxism said the exact same thing. The Soviet Union never claimed that for itself as an entity. But Marx, you know, his eccentric definition of the working class was the final communism was a final word of the historical process. I don't think people realize just how deeply revolutionary and ideological capitalism is in general, let alone the postmodern variant where nothing is actually being produced except images. Of course, you know, the U.S. is now in a very similar position to the Soviet Union in the 1970s. The defense spending is about 20% of the entire budget, and that doesn't include billions in the hidden in other departments and off budget. You know, the Pentagon, how the Pentagon operates, drugs and everything else, which was pretty much what the Soviets were spending in 1980, a little bit higher, maybe 20 to 22%. Infrastructure decay, a total lack of unity amongst the different groups, the dependency, specifically American, the dependency on illegal immigration to keep wages down, and just irrational policies that come from the self-interest of the ruling class rather than any interest in economic development. Most Americans have no idea what Zelensky, who did call Russians in Eastern Ukraine creatures. I even saw it in the original. I remember Clinton's people saying the exact same thing about Serbs in Kosovo. It's, you know, the rules-based order, which is something that Lavrov and Putin make fun of all the time. There are no rules. Except that since it's the spokesman of the historical process, that's what it's the spokesman of. And we all know who the mentality, the messianic mentality of the Jews, which has always been their Achilles heel, that once they take over, they believe that the Messiah is coming, so there's no limits on what they can do. And so, I mean, the Messiah is going to destroy their enemies anyway, so we can, you know, there's no limit on their acquisition. And we can't talk about this without talking about that particular entity. And, you know, Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya, et cetera, he mentions all of this. And it's not an accident that just the three countries he mentions, Yugoslavia, Iraq, Libya, were all on the cusp of the First World. But Yugoslavia was pretty much already there. I mean, they were making their own cars as bad as they were. Iraq and Libya were switching from oil. They were building nuclear reactors. Income was going up. Their investment, you know, the state was important. All, you know, families were subsidized and didn't have to pay taxes and all that. That was the threat. You know, the nonsense anti-war movement, which doesn't exist anymore, the anti-nuke movement, which doesn't exist anymore, which means it was controlled from the beginning, were, you know, claiming that this war was about oil. That's why they were opposed to it. And when I mentioned that the U.S. gets no oil from these places, this has far more to do with keeping any competitors away from Israel than the U.S. Especially today, now that the British economy has officially, according to the Bank of England, has officially tanked. It's going to go right back to the IMF days in the 70s. But of course, I don't think Lavrov, he's using double meanings here on purpose. And I think the American elite knows what he means. You know, have they banned English or languages? Well, in huge parts of America, English isn't spoken at all, and that's subsidized by the state. Anglo-Saxons as subhuman. Well, yeah, many times. both in action and in word. And heavy weapons, who knows, that may be coming soon. The use of these immigrants in the U.S. And in Europe against us is just the reason why they're there. And mocking them all by saying that, you know, when Russia has taken over an area, it's always only because the referendum has permitted it. And whenever they leave or secede from Russia, they go into tank, like Ukraine, which is fourth world today. Any country that becomes part of that, the Eurasian Customs Union, ends up doing very, very well. And Belarus is a classic example. The Central Asian states prior to COVID were doing very well because they had a strong central leadership, and that was part of directing the economy. They had state central banks and all that. That's part of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization ideology too. It's not a profit motive bank. It's a national bank. Most Americans have no idea what Zelensky has said or what he's done to the Russians of eastern Ukraine. You can in America call them subhuman and attack them and call them creatures and demand that they be removed from America. It's no problem. You know, the idiot Republicans and the idiot Democrats are saying the same thing. They don't know what they're talking about. They're told what to do. Have they improved the human rights situation or promote the rule of law? None of this matters. The rule of law, of course, is a myth. Oligarchy doesn't understand law or rights or any absolute except its own self-interest. And even that, it struggles with sometimes, especially when you know you're going to be bailed out. So this is what Lavrov is saying here has layers of meanings. But to give this semi-theological idea that the U.S. is a spokesman for history, which it says over and over again, you know, even that moron who was installed in office says it. You have a lot of politicians claiming this. The Clinton administration said it. The Bush administration said it. Even the elder Bush was saying it, that the U.S. is a special empire, not because it has anything to do with providence, but because it speaks for history, which was a classic Marxist idea. And Solzhenitsyn is vindicated because he said, this is what they're going to start saying. This is what capitalism really is. It's as revolutionary as Soviet Marxism ever was. And you have these dumb conservatives in the Republican Party that continues to defend corporate America like the Reds are coming to take it over, like this is 1960. And it just shows you the illiteracy of the American talking class and why the real intellectuals aren't a part of it and couldn't be a part of it even if they wanted to. So Lavrov, as always, is saying a lot in very few words.
There's no acceptance of plurality or diversity of thought, no acceptance that there might be a different way of doing things with this unipolar model. Well, Lavrov continues. He says, in its attempts to revive the unipolar model under the label of a rules-based order, the West has been imposing dividing lines everywhere, following the logic of a block-based confrontation where you are either with us or against us. There is no third option available or compromises. The United States persisted with its irrational policy to expand NATO to the east and bring its military infrastructure closer to Russia's borders. Now the US wants to subjugate Asia. At the June NATO summit in Madrid, this self-proclaimed defensive alliance announced the indivisibility of security for the Euro-Atlantic and the Indo-Pacific region. Closed frameworks are being created as part of the Indo-Pacific strategies, which undermine ASEAN's open and inclusive regional architecture that has taken shape over decades. Building on all these developments, they decided to play with fire regarding Taiwan, even promising it military support. So what is the problem there between ASEAN? What is ASEAN for a start? And why does it have this issue with NATO, Matt, you know?
Well, a long time ago, ASEAN is the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And it was supposed to be, I think it was created in the 60s. I haven't read about it in a while, but it was supposed to be the Asian NATO. And it never quite turned out that way. It never was as unified as NATO was. And in fact, doesn't really particularly serve Western interests. You know, Burma is a member. So trying to take it over is just part of the typical unilateral process, unipolar process. You can't have a unified military or financial system without having a unified ideological system. It has to be justified, not just to the common population, but even the people who are running it. They have to actually believe that they're serving the pantheon of historical gods here. And he's right to mention the June summit, that somehow now NATO has claimed sovereignty, or at least equality, with ASEAN. And they've already demanding this country get kicked out. They're not allowed to protect their companies. They have to permit American firms to go in and rape the place, like they always do. And that's the price you pay for American support, which is nothing more than inserting them into the international order, the Great Reset now, which is most certainly not in the interests of even elite members of those societies. It's not a very popular idea following the American dictates after 1997, where George Soros deliberately destroyed those economies and the currency meltdown starting in Thailand, one of the central states in ASEAN. There is no love for America, for that kind of unrestrained global liberalism, which is, as Dugin says, completely totalitarian. Think of the U.S. has been in a depression now for a long time. And you think of the U.S. during the Great Depression versus now. The U.S. survived the Great Depression because the United States at the time was a highly unified, white, overwhelmingly Christian nation, especially Protestant. That's how they were able to pull together. You know, there's all these stories about people putting on their ties, filthy as it was, to go out and search through the garbage. The exact opposite is true here. You have a fat, lazy population where it's much easier just to believe whatever they're spoon-fed rather than actually do some thinking. Rebellion is simply out of the question. How many people have the millions who have lost their homes over the last 10 years? Millions without pensions, all gone into the pockets of elite bankers, and still nothing. Stolen elections, and you know, all they do is talk about how we're going to get our guys in the next time. There's going to be no honest elections in 2020. The most honest elections recently have been in the republics, now part of Russia. Four of them, I mentioned in my last show, Zaporozhye, Kherson, and of course New Russia. So four total, averaging about 92-93% wanting to get into Russia, which was no surprise. Everyone knows that. And they've been fighting for Russia from the beginning. They have no right to, they shouldn't be in Ukraine. Ukraine's a fourth world state. The minute Russia takes over, they take the ruble, which means that they're taking a very, one of the strongest currencies in the world right now. Everything they have of value now goes up 100-200%. That's why you have a huge rush of Ukrainians to come into those areas where Putin's had to streamline the process of becoming a Russian citizen, because there are so many, including in the military. You know, no one wants to live in a fourth world hole, especially under this circumstance. This winter is going to be very rough unless this war ends and Ukraine comes into the Russian fold. They're already destroying, talk about rules-based order. Yeah, they're stealing Russian assets abroad. They've deliberately, the regime has destroyed the main gas pipeline. Nord Stream 1, Nord Stream 2 isn't finished yet. Biden threatened that a while ago in one of his rare lucid moments. That's what the so-called rules-based order is. But America during the Great Depression was a relatively healthy state. America today is exactly the opposite. It's broke. There's no unity. There's no moral purpose, no religious purpose. It's a group of very, very sick, mentally ill people who try and fail to make sense of what's going on around them.
Well, next he brings up the manufactured food and energy crisis. The Secretary General also has a special role to play when it comes to mobilizing efforts to overcome the food and energy crises that have resulted from uncontrolled money printing in the United States and the European Union during the pandemic, as well as the European Union's irresponsible and unprofessional actions on the hydrocarbon markets. Defying the most basic common sense, Washington and Brussels compounded the situation by declaring an economic war against Russia. This resulted in higher global prices for food, fertilizer, oil, and gas. We welcome efforts by the Secretary General, who helped broker the July 22, 2022 Istanbul agreements. However, these agreements must be carried out. So far, most of the ships carrying Ukrainian grain have not been directed to the poorest countries, while the United States and the EU have yet to fully remove the financial and logistical obstacles that prevent Russia from exporting its grain and fertilizer. We have been saying for several weeks that 300,000 tons of fertilizer have been held up at European ports and have been proposing to ship them free of charge to the African countries that need them. But the European Union has not responded. So once again, we see it's these sanctions that is actually preventing the food getting to Africa, and it's the sanctions that are preventing the gas getting into Europe. I mean, it's all being set up by America and the EU, isn't it, Matt?
Well, Liz Truss and the head of NATO, spokesman for the EU, the idiot in Washington, they've all, the idiot in Canada, have all come out and said that freezing for human rights is a praiseworthy thing. They're deliberately making sure, which is why the Nord Stream 1 was temporarily destroyed. And by the way, I haven't seen any of the environmentalists scream of all the natural gas pumped into the ocean. No one's saying a word. Again, all this stuff is so tightly controlled. But they're saying that the suffering and the third worldization, now official, of Northern Europe, Western Europe, in the U.S., is at least in Europe, is worth it. Because it supports our agenda. No one cares about Ukraine. No one knows anything about Ukraine. You might as well start talking about Azerbaijan, Armenia, or the Solomon Islands, which are in the news recently, as some of you know. But the truth of the matter is the U.S. deliberately, systematically waged war against its farmers. One or two American states could very easily feed the world if all of its arable was planted. Because American farmers were so overwhelmingly efficient, they either had to leave or be paid a small subsidy not to plant or not to plant certain things. So the U.S. doesn't have an infrastructure for an industrial or an agricultural economy. So the world is drowning in food. The only problem is that the American farmer has been so displaced and deliberately bankrupted and driven off their land, everything taken over by ConAgra, and now I think Microsoft or Bill Gates is the biggest landowner in America now, doing these non-food crops and GMOs, growing corn for ethanol, this kind of thing, rather than producing food. The U.S. could, the U.S. still, with a handful of farmers, produces more food than anyone could possibly eat. So he's right. This is completely artificial. But the world's greatest producer of grain is Russia, and he's more than happy to help feed anyone who wants it. They're overwhelmed with food just like the Americans are. Now, the Africa thing, Ukraine is at the African level in terms of economic development. It's a fourth world country. So I'm not sure why delivering food from Ukraine to Africa really matters. Ukraine's in the same boat, and increasingly Western Europe and Northern Europe is in the same boat as the Africans are. Ethnic divisions, no industry, collapsing currencies, and dependence. And when you have a population that is so dependent economically and everything else, you're not going to have a population that's going to do anything. Starving to death, having a nuclear war, having a massive world war, the regime has already said these are acceptable sacrifices we're willing to make for the domination of liberalism throughout the globe. We had a whole show on the Pentagon's concept of a limited nuclear war, which was condemned in the 80s when communism existed in the Soviet Union. It's now okay only when nationalism exists in the former Soviet Union. That's the difference between the two policies. There was no real Cold War, but there certainly is a hot war now. Nationalism has always been the enemy of the Great Reset, the New World Order, international capitalism, the dependence, whatever you want to call it. Marxism certainly was no problem. They're blood brothers. But ideologically speaking, nationalism is a different story. And that's why they will say we'll mow you down. We'll send you to a war you don't even know where it is just for our agenda. They've already said this. This isn't a secret. Everything that Lavrov is saying here is just basic common sense, but it'll get you thrown off and banned every platform you can imagine just for saying it.
Well, next he talks about some of the Western promises that have been broken. He says, how have Russia's actions over the past decade actually infringed upon the interests of its opponents? Could it be that they cannot forgive us because it is the position of our country that made the military and strategic détente possible in the 1980s and 1990s? Or that we voluntarily dissolved the Warsaw Treaty Organization, depriving NATO of its raison d'etre, or that we supported Germany's reunification without any conditions and contrary to the positions of London and Paris, that we withdrew our armed forces from Europe, Asia, and Latin America and recognized the independence of the former Soviet republics, that we believed the promises by the Western leaders that they would not expand NATO to the east by a single inch. And when this process started, we agreed to basically legitimize it by signing the Russia-NATO Founding Act. Could it be that we infringed upon the West's interests when we warned it that bringing its military infrastructure closer to our border would be unacceptable to us? And what really surprised me here is what he was saying about how the Russia supported Germany's reunification without any conditions, and that was contrary to the positions of London and Paris. Do you know anything about that, Matt?
Well, what he's trying to say is that Russians at the time, or what was left of the Soviet Union, didn't think it was in their interest for Germany to become this large industrialized state again, despite the fact that they have far more in common than they do in opposition. The Russians knew at the time that Germany was not an independent country, that the U.S. wanted it unified, but Western Europe, certainly the French, didn't want it unified for very obvious reasons. And back when Britain was in the EU, I mean, it would dominate and completely control the EU and maybe even at some point NATO. But of course, the problem is the Soviet Union at the time was working from a position of weakness. Their economic system had finally given way, and so withdrawing was almost a necessity. But remember, the Soviet Union in the early 80s or even the late 70s was far more conservative politically than anything that was going on in the West. No one gave a damn about Marx by that point. No one cared about communism by that point. It was a kind of a strange Soviet nationalism, knowing full well what the West had in store for them. This is why the coup attempts in the early 90s were very popular. The Soviet Union was very popular. We're not talking about the Stalinist gulags. They're talking about a unified economic space that could make war on Western liberalism, which is why today, from then on, seeing what happened in Russia and Ukraine in the 90s and in Ukraine continuing to this day, no one believes in Western liberalism, Western capitalism, except this tiny handful of the sexual deviants or the handful of Jews left in Russia who promote this stuff. And of course, American agents there. But otherwise, they want nothing to do with the West then or now. They were aware that the Soviet Union was generally, especially in the periphery, was generally popular because it did provide a unified economic space. And that was dismantled in that 10-year period right after that. But his point is kind of an odd one, in that through weakness, Russians had to abandon all of these positions. They simply didn't, especially after Afghanistan, they didn't have the ability, the money anymore to maintain it. Cuba especially, they spent a fortune there. And if the Soviets can do that, then why can't the Americans do it? And that goes back to the notion of the U.S. being a spokesman for world history, that it has a semi-theological position in the world, that it has rights and no one else does. Because the U.S. is the vanguard of the utopia of liberal capitalism that they're imposing on everybody. And how dare you? It's no different than the Soviet Union. Considering you insane if you oppose the working class, because no sane person could. And it's no different here. The parallels with the Soviet Union in the from the 30s to the 60s is uncanny. I've been saying this for a very long time. And of course, the U.S. lied. I remember the discussions. I remember the New York Times talking about how there's no interest in pushing NATO to the east, but it was irresistible. Every promise made, every historical example has been violated in every way. One of the most blatant was Trump's pulling out of the mid-range nuclear weapons treaty, which we talked about on this show. Now all of a sudden, nuclear weapons are on the table. The average American, even the average educated American, doesn't understand any of this. But the problem with what Lavrov is saying is that the Soviets were in a position of weakness. Russia now is in a position of tremendous strength. And it's still – their reaction to the West is very belated. We've talked about that on this program many times. But he's saying something that the world already knows, that the Americans, the regime as a whole, can't be trusted. It'll turn its back on its friends today and then go back the next day. So and that's why – and the Russians have taken a long time to understand this. At least the Russian ruling class has taken a long time to understand this. Lavrov is telling the world that now the gloves are off.
Well, next he talks about just that, where Russia stopped idly standing by. He said, did we have to sit idly in the face of Kiev's policy to impose a total ban on the Russian language, education, the Russian media and culture, its insistence that Russians be expelled from Crimea, and when it declared war against Donbass, the authorities in Kiev back then, as well as the current leadership, have designated these people as creatures, not people. This is what we hear from the country's most senior official. How could we tolerate this? And that's the point, isn't it? I mean, you've got ethnic Russians that are being abused in the Donbass region. How could they tolerate that? I mean, it's the same situation that Hitler was under, wasn't it? How could he tolerate the abuse of the Germans in Danzig? That was the start of the Second World War. And we have seen exactly the same situation here. Russia being put into a position where they could do nothing else but go in there to protect their people. Matt, what do you think of what he has to say here?
Again, this is a simple common sense, but most people, you have, you know, university professors who have no idea of the American policy via Ukraine and in the eastern regions. I've been talking about it since at least 2004 during the Orange Revolution. Now, Kiev doesn't act independently, no different than Kosovo. These are colonies. Kiev is a colony of the U.S. Kosovo is the colony of the European Union. The American policy gets to hide behind Kiev. There is no functional economy. The entire world of the currency and about 80% of the budget comes from Western aid, especially from the U.S. I don't remember anyone voting on this. And of course, all the misappropriated money going to military stuff, which had nothing to do with the Ukrainian economy. They're not even producing it, nor do they know how to use it. And it just gets destroyed anyway. All this money should have been plowed into economic development. But you don't have a system that has any sense of legality. You have the new Kazaria movement, which I've spoken about at great length, which had taken over. And this is one of the main drives for the war in Ukraine, is to resurrect the idea of new Kazaria, which was down in Odessa, which is a fairly now that that's failed, is this relatively pro-Russian area, in the southern area, a port city. So and he knows this. He knows that Ukrainian policy is essentially American policy. America is a combatant in this war, but just like many years ago, it's just a proxy war, mostly done by mercenaries from around the globe on the American taxpayer money, as well as corporations who are helping to finance this. Unless this war is won completely, not just in the eastern territories, but throughout the country, this government, of course, is very unpopular as it is. But you simply threaten the population, saying, well, if we go, you're not going to get any American aid anymore. And that's the only thing that's keeping you in business. So everything he's saying here is true. The average American doesn't know. But that's why Ukraine is perfect. It's so obscure to most people, including Ukrainians living in this country, that they could say whatever they want and people are just going to have to believe it. And they do.
Well, he continues saying, considering the inability of the Western countries to engage in talks and the fact that the Kiev regime was continuing the war against its own people, we were left with no choice but to recognize the independence of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics and launch a special military operation to protect Russians and other people in Donbass, while also removing threats to our own security, which NATO has been consistently creating on Ukrainian territory and which is de facto right on our border. Interesting, he says here about the Kiev regime was continuing a war against its own people. I mean, that's what was continuing to be alleged about Bashar al-Assad, wasn't it? He was attacking his own people. Gaddafi was attacking his own people. And so they're basically saying the same as what NATO has said about these other countries and then trying to do something about it themselves. Do you think, Matt?
Well, you could be supportive of Ukrainian nationalism. And in fact, if you are, you have to despise this present government. This is a classic case of a government simply using and manipulating ethnic symbols to maintain legitimacy, and it's failed to do that. Russia has never been a particular enemy in the Ukrainian mind, even in the West. Positive attitudes have been the norm throughout Ukraine up until and probably continuing into the war. If that weren't the case, the American administration wouldn't have to destroy every media outlet that opposed them. Any outlet or educational institution using Russian was destroyed. And of course, it was the American investors that came in and built these, and the oligarchs, of course, which are a transnational product anyway, built these media empires supporting one ideology. Now you have essentially a unified state media under the private sector with billionaires, both domestic and foreign. And it's not an accident. This is the first thing that, that Russia did during the war when it first started, is hitting all these areas, destroying this media, or as much of it as they could, this media centralization. So and you know, the Russians, ever since 2014, have been trying to come to a negotiated settlement with the Minsk agreements, the first one and the second one, that the Ukrainians immediately, I mean, as the talks were going on, were violating them. Russians were far too patient here in trying to deal with Ukrainian society that was under American control, really since, you know, to a great extent, and since 2004, with the exception of Yanukovych. So that's, you know, everything he's saying here is basic common sense. The U.S. doesn't want to put nuclear weapons on Russia's border. You don't expect anything to happen? Yeah, Russia is so right here. It's so correct, and it has the moral high ground here. But media control, as always, in the West, is the enemy. If the media doesn't cover it, it doesn't exist.
Well, finally, he makes reference to the referendums. The West is now in a temper tantrum over the referendums in Ukraine's Luhansk, Donetsk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions. However, people there are simply reacting to the advice from the head of the Kiev regime, Volodymyr Zelensky. In one of his interviews in August 2021, he advised all those who consider themselves Russians to leave for Russia for the benefit of their children and grandchildren. This is what people living in the regions I have mentioned are doing, and they are taking the land where their ancestors had lived for centuries with them. And that's the point, because people will say, well, when did the Russians actually come there? And they've been there for centuries. And Nova Russia is what the name of the region was called before, which just means New Russia. So it was New Russia. It wasn't a part of Ukraine originally. Matt, what are your final thoughts on all of this?
Even if the eastern areas were 100% Ukrainian, they would still want to join Russia. The eastern areas are what's left of Ukrainian industry. It will be dismantled if Kiev is able to take them over. I mean, they've already said that. Kiev has no independence. They need to dismantle this for the sake of paying off debt. So it doesn't matter who's running things over there, what ethnic group is running things there. Ukraine is fourth world. Russia is first world. The choice is very simple.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Dan. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.